You're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And this is Truth Quest with Melody on this is Truth Quest with Melody, and we're community-supported radio, and we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And we're going to have an opening song here that's kind of apropos to our interview this evening. And my co-host tonight is Professor Dr. Eric Carlstrom and Steve Filling. And here we go.
Well, I sure life trouble in a dark and dusty mine. It's been my occupation, now I walk picket line. It was down in bloody Harlem where they tried. You could see it in their eyes. The company hired some gun thugs. Many miners died, it said. They came to bust the union, but they lost their lives instead.
Hey, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? You're either for the rich man or the union standing strong. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? You're either for the rich man or the union standing strong. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? You're either for the rich man or the union standing strong. Which side are you on?
Yeah, I'm here. And I guess
on?
He's playing the song.
Yeah, we've got you.
Okay.
Okay, that was... I'm going to let Dr. Carlstrom explain a little bit about that song, but again, Dr. Carlstrom is professor of geography at California State University, Stanislaus, with nearly 30 years teaching experience. His academic research has focused on using soils and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And our special guest tonight is Dr. Stephen Filling teaches management control systems and business ethics at CSU Stanislaus. He has been involved in faculty governance for over a decade and is currently speaker of the faculty at CSU Stanislaus. Okay, and let me do one other thing. The views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Cahan staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And Eric and Steve, you're there, correct?
Yep, I'm here.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great.
Now, I'll explain the song real quick before we get started. I have a bluegrass band here in Turlock, and it's called the Bluegrass Conspiracy. And that song is called Union Man, which I think, like you said, is appropriate for our topic tonight. It's a song about the miner strike in Harlan, Kentucky back in the 50s. We've just recorded that, and it seems fitting because we've got difficult times here at California State University campuses, all through the state of California, of course, and the university system. One of the sub themes in this all the issues that are surround the budget crises is kind of a power struggle, and the California Faculty Association is our union, and they've been trying to hold the university together from the point of view of what the faculty think is best for the state, and so as you mentioned in your introduction, Dr. Steve Filling is our faculty union representative. He's also Speaker of the Faculty Senate. So he's well-placed to discuss some of the problems that we're facing right now. And it's a very complex situation. So I'm glad we have a couple hours to kind of explore the issues. So anyway, welcome, Steve, to this radio interview. And could you just tell us a little bit about our situation right now and the issue that the top issue that you think we're facing?
Okay, very happy to be here. A brief background: the CSU basically got put together from the normal colleges, the teaching colleges in the 60s. And the idea was to have a comprehensive university that could provide access to college education for effectively the top third of the graduating high school students in California. It was part of the originally the Donahoe Higher Education Act, and there was a very famous master plan for higher education in California that originated in the 60s with the notion that higher ed shouldn't be constrained by economic resources. I can remember growing up as a child in Iowa in the 60s wishing along with all of my neighbors that I could get to California somehow so I could afford to go to college. That sort of was everybody's dream because there was no tuition out here. There were fees and that was it. Over the intervening far too many years, the prices have gone up, and the situation we face right now is that the state faces a large budget problem, as quite a few organizations do. And in the case of California, a lot of spending is mandated by the Constitution. Unfortunately, education isn't included among that. And so what we've seen in the last year is the CSU as a system, total funding cut by right around $1 billion, which has had some real serious effects on our ability to provide education to do what we think our mission is, which is to provide education for the majority of people that go to college in California.
Steve, how much is that $1 billion percentage of the total budget?
It's pretty close to a third.
Wow. That is a huge budget change.
Go ahead.
Steve, could you just, since you kind of introduced the grand ideal of the California State University system, let's just talk a little bit about the size of this university when you put all the campuses together, and then how our campus fits into the larger picture. How many how many universities are there within the California State University, how many students, how many faculty, et cetera?
Okay, well, there are 23 campuses. There were plans for, I believe, 24 2 years ago, but the latest one got obviously put on hold with funding difficulties. So 23 campuses, they range in size probably from, the Maritime Academy is probably the smallest with about 800 students, and the largest is probably CSU Los Angeles with over 30,000. In total, well over 500,000 students, about plus or minus, 20,000 faculty a year and a half ago. I think we might be down significantly below that now.
Okay, and
officially, it's the largest higher ed system in the country.
Perhaps in the world, wouldn't you say?
I suspect it's got to be in the running.
Yeah. And of those 20,000 faculty, how many are full-time, tenured or tenure track, would you say?
Oh, I'd guess probably 15. Well, no, actually, about maybe 12,000 at most.
Yeah.
And it varies widely by campus. The Stanislaus campus tends to be relatively highly tenured, tenure track, that is permanent faculty, about 60%. Some of the urban campuses, the larger campuses, tend to be below 50%.
Okay, and the rest would be part-time faculty who teach a course here and teach a course there and then don't have benefits. So, of course, from a administrative or management point of view, they save costs on the part-timers, and they tend to like that, I guess. And how big is our own university, California State University, Stanislaus, then?
Let's see, in 2008, we were right at about 8,000 students. We are down to about 7,300 right now. That number floats. We tend to refer to things as full-time equivalent students, and we're at about 7,000 for that, which puts us in the low end of probably the bottom third tier of CSUs. We're about plus or minus 2% of the system.
So are our problems unique, or are the budget cuts that we're facing, the furloughing of the faculty and the staff and the administration of 10% of our time and our pay, and the many, many classes which have been canceled and the many, many faculty that have been laid off even this year, are we unique, or is this system-wide?
There's an argument to be made that we may be hit a little harder because of our size. And that has, I think, more to do with the fact that because of our size, we don't have as much slippage. There aren't as many people there, so it's hard to reduce ratably. That is, when we have to reduce effectively, we have to lose a person. We don't have 10 people. We can cut each one up 10%. It's also the case that our campus, Stanislaus, and the Dominguez Hills campus, which is in metro L.A., are suffering. We're about the same size, and we're both suffering disproportionately. It seems to be campuses our size that are faced with the very real threat of having complete programs just canceled.
Entire departments and programs then are under jeopardy at the more or less at the whim of administration decisions. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's one of the sticking points for us at the CSU. The Board of Trustees, the body that oversees the entire system, has made repeated statements that each campus needs to have policies in place to deal with program discontinuation, that is, to decide whether or not programs should continue, to have a process in place to make sure that, for instance, all the students in that program do get to graduate, to try and find ways to keep the full-time faculty there. And we have policies in place. The only question at this point is whether our administration chooses to follow those policies. And frankly, the Board of Trustees is saying you need to have those policies. They're a little less intense about saying, and furthermore, you need to follow those policies.
Well, just to bring it home to our campus, Steve, what kind of budget cutbacks are we looking at kind of on an annual basis, and what's the total budget at our school of 7,000 full-time student equivalents?
Our total state budget is right about $90,000. Well, our total budget is about $90,000. There's a difference for us.
$90 million. Yeah.
You wouldn't think an accountant would make that mistake.
We'll keep you on your toes there, Steve. That's okay. $90 million.
There's a difference. Yeah. And some of that money is what's called restricted, which means we can only spend it on certain things. For instance, we get a fairly significant chunk of money, which we're only allowed to spend on financial aid for students. We get some significant funding we're only allowed to spend on labs for education, et cetera. But plus or minus about $90,000. Our budget
$90 million.
Our budget was cut about, over the last 2 years, I'd guess close to $13 million. That's per year.
$13 million each year, or for both years?
Cumulatively over the years.
$13 million. Okay, so we're down down to about $77 million. So I suppose we've lost what, about 15-20% almost in 2 years.
Yeah, it's a significant chunk down, and it's rather hard to measure because in the CSU historically, way back in the 60s, there was this thing called the Orange Book that was a vast conglomeration of formulas used to calculate how things were funded. That was officially taken out of existence. However, the baseline for campus budgeting still remained there, and it shifts up and down depending on enrollment. And on our campus, we have always been growing at about the maximum rate allowed to grow, so we're always getting a little more money. So sometimes it's hard to compare apples to apples when we talk about the budget because we're a different size than we were before.
Right. And
probably the most obvious impact to us is that we were the chancellor of the system. Charlie Reed announced that because of our budget cuts, the entire system would be serving about 10% fewer students. So basically we told 45,000 students across California, sorry, we don't have classes for you. On our campus, that was about plus or minus 700 students.
So the state is this just this year was kind of closing its doors for the first time to new students, really for the first time in its history. Would you say that's the case?
Yeah. Some of the campuses, especially the large urban ones, had been what's called impacted, which means they had more than enough students for the slots they had. A lot of campuses like ours were places where there was enough space that we could continue to grow. This year, for the first time, I think every one of the CSU campuses closed registration and admissions in November or October, which means that, exactly right, sorry, we don't have any room for you. One of the struggles for us has been, how do we deal with the fact that we have students here now that need classes? On our campus, we cut probably 100 classes out of the fall semester. When we do that, obviously, there are fewer slots for the students we have to go into. So one of the ancillary facts to that is the classes we do have gotten larger as the faculty have said, okay, I'll let in three or four extra students because I know they need to get classes. And the problem for our students has become, well, I can get into these three classes, but those may not be the three classes that I need to graduate.
Yeah, so they wind up taking an extra year or half a year or something like that as a result of these inconveniences, correct?
Yes, in the case of business college where I teach, we've had a fair number of students who are going to be delayed until next summer, if we're allowed to offer classes in the summer. If not, they're delayed for a year till next fall to get the classes they need to finish their degrees.
Yeah. Now, so what we see then is we see this great dream of a virtually free higher education for citizens of California, which materialized in the 60s. And then it began to kind of get whittled away. I guess we could mention Proposition 13, which was passed in 1978 in this state, which all of a sudden put a limit on property taxes. And, of course, property taxes to the state become a very important source of funding for education at all levels. And so this particular proposition, which was placed on the ballot, we've had a lot of ballot initiatives since, put a limit of 1.1% of total assessed value of real estate, homes, et cetera, for an upper limit on real estate taxes or property taxes, and also mandated that any additional kind of tax that could be used in this regard would have to pass through the state Senate and House with two-thirds majority. And, of course, it's very difficult to get a two-thirds majority. So what that has essentially done is kept the revenue streams from growing since 98, more or less freezing in place, kind of putting in a ceiling or an upper limit on the funding that we have available for higher education. Is that, would you agree with that, Steve?
Yes, I think clearly the Proposition 13 was sort of, you know, how Jarvis's brainchild became the genesis of what a lot of people in California would say is an out-of-control mechanism for interference with budget, and that coupled with the reality that in California requires a two-thirds vote to pass budget and tax measures means that we're deeply constrained with revenue. We also exist in a society which for the past 20 to 30 years has had an increasing focus on incarceration. So the cost of prisons has gone up and up and up as we incarcerate more and more of the population. And in California, it is to the point now where the federal government has set a judge up to effectively force the state to fund what they think minimum facilities should be for those incarcerated. And what we see now is that the state is spending disproportionate, well, I guess that's a judgment call, disproportionate to me amounts of money on incarcerating people. It's been estimated somewhere between $45,000 and $60,000 per year to incarcerate a single inmate. And given the choice, I think we could probably provide somebody with a full college program and indeed living expenses for far less than that.
Yeah, what would be the state contribution to a student's education over 4 years? As compared with its contribution, say, to incarceration, or say on a yearly basis, if the state's paying $45,000 or $50,000 a year to incarcerate someone, what is the state contribution to our students' education?
We talk about at our campus the quote fully funded unquote rate, and that seems to be somewhere right around $11,000 to $12,000 per year per full time student. What we're actually funded by the state for is right about $7,500, $8,000 per student.
And then the student pays the rest, more or less?
Right. And our students' fees have, well, they went up 32% this fall. I think over the past probably 5 years, they've come pretty close to doubling.
And that's what I hear from the students.
And part of the reason for that is that there's a requirement in the statutes that set up the CSU and how it behaves that one-third of increased fees be reserved to provide financial aid for those that can't afford the fees. So effectively, if we want to raise the fees by 100, we have to provide a fee increase of about 140, and then obviously the 40 goes off to be held for those who can't afford it, as established by the financial aid system.
Yeah, but to go back to the priorities of the state, as I recall, I think in the decade of the 90s, the state of California built about 20 prisons and one new campus for the California State University. And this this shows incredible and I think maybe misplaced priorities. So for whatever, do you have any concept as to why the state would want to invest so much of its money in prisons as opposed to education?
Truthfully, no. I ponder that a lot. I find myself often thinking that if I look at the crime rates, recidivism, that is people that are incarcerated coming out and being convicted of yet another crime, they're a lot higher than the crime rates coming out of higher ed, we see a negative correlation between educational level and crime rate.
I just wanted to ask, too, now you guys are primarily focusing on California, but does this also kind of go across the board with other states and their higher education system?
I think some of it's unique to the way California chooses to fund things, but I know that, for instance, I went to graduate school in Louisiana, and Louisiana has the same sort of situation as California, where spending for almost everything, in fact, I think spending for everything except health care and education is literally written into their statutes. So when they have not enough money, that's what gets cut. And it's also true that people are increasing rates of incarceration across the country. I think for a lot of states, however, one of the concomitant trends is the privatization of prisons. So, for instance, in Louisiana, the giant corporations control the prisons, and that tends to be significantly cheaper than having the state run them.
Would it be true that the state would then create the facility and then hand them off to the private corporations or sell them off to the private corporations?
That the experience I've seen with them, yeah, that's what happens. The state creates the prisons and then does some kind of a lease arrangement with the authority that runs them. In some cases, there are huge corporations that will go and build prisons. The problem with that, I think, was most evident in Texas a few years ago, where a large corporation had prison grounds, and they were literally shipping prisoners there from other parts of the country, and naturally when they had a jailbreak, the folk that lived in Texas got a little bit upset at the notion of criminals from all across the nation escaping from a prison in their backyard.
Yeah, well, the reason that I asked that question and bring that up is that I think we may see a similar pattern with education as education moves towards being privatized at all levels, and I think perhaps one of the big issues we need to discuss tonight is the trend or tendency towards privatizing public education right on our own campus. And so that's why I brought that up. And I think maybe we see that with several sectors of society, like healthcare, which has now been pretty thoroughly privatized. And we see now with healthcare that it costs a lot more, and we get, we may get good service, but it's not attainable for a lot of people. But so this move towards privatization, taking a public asset, selling it off to corporations or leasing it to corporations, or somehow making it attractive as an investment opportunity for corporations, would you say you see the handwriting on the wall there too, Steve?
Well, to me, the handwriting on the wall is that people in our society have sometimes a much misplaced, if childlike, faith in the market. And I think what people don't notice is that for some things, I think healthcare and education probably top the list, the market might not necessarily be a very effective mechanism for resource allocation, because the people that are effectively trying to buy the product aren't really able to discern the quality of the product they get. The best example I can think of is that when you have a cold, as I do, obviously from my voice, you tend to go to the doctor and say, I need you to make me better. However, our only mechanism for determining whether we're better or not is whether the symptoms go away. Note, we don't know whether or not the doctor actually cured us. We just know the symptoms went away. In other words, we think we're buying something, but we don't know how to measure it. And I think the same is true of education. When we talk to our students and we say, why are you here? They usually say, to learn things, to get a degree. How do you know if you learn things? Well, you gave me a good grade. For a lot of our students, I think the knowledge we impart to them may not be evident until some later point in their careers. And obviously, we don't have a system whereby they can wait to pay for it until they figure out the worth of what they got. So there's a basic imbalance.
Pardon me, it's a basic what?
There's just a basic imbalance in knowledge. The notion of a market as a good mechanism for setting price hinges upon the notion that both parties have information about what they're buying and what they're giving up. Yeah. We don't have that knowledge in this case.
Can I also ask a question that, do you find that sometimes, you know, say like with education, when they're having budget cuts, they kind of like to start cutting things where they know that the people will notice most and will most likely put money towards. And yet, when you have a situation in your state where there is such a big shortfall, do you see what I'm saying as far as, you know, they sometimes like to kind of make the squeaky wheel the one that gets the grease?
Oh, precisely. In fact, I teach budgeting to MBA students, and one of the things we talk about is precisely that sort of game playing. When somebody says, well, I'm going to give you less money for your operation, your first response is usually, well, that's going to eliminate my ability to do anything productive. And I think what we saw with the chancellor and the state legislature this year is exactly that. The state legislature says we have less money. We can't give you as much. The chancellor says, okay, well, if you do that, I'm going to have to educate 45,000 less students, effectively saying 45,000 students and their parents and their siblings and their grandparents are going to be calling the legislature and yelling, put my kid back in college. It's a really clear strategy of, I'm going to take away the one thing you want me to do if you cut my budget. And, of course, the time commitment strategy on the part of the people with money is to try to control what the administration of that organization is able to cut. Unfortunately, people that administer large organizations tend to be very clever about making sure they get to cut something that you won't want them to cut.
And how would you say that, because you were saying something about those that are less fortunate, part of that money for tuition and has to go towards them. How much of that do you think is really affecting the fact that maybe those that do have the money are starting to go into another direction, and then that load is left on the those that really don't have that kind of funds to support those that don't have money for higher education?
At least at our campus, we're seeing more demand, that is, more people trying to come in the door rather than less. But part of that is a function of the fact that as a state-supported school, I think full-time tuition for our campus is about $8,000 a year, whereas going to, for example, the University of the Pacific, which is about 50 miles away, is over $25,000 a year. So we're seeing people shift towards us, away from them. The problem for us is that one-third set aside to help people that can't afford it doesn't cover everything. About 80% of our students are getting federally subsidized loans or, you know, grants of one form or another. We have a disproportionately low economic
median.
I'm not sure how to say it. Yes, low economic median. Our students tend to be older. They tend to be working. I do surveys in my classes, and 60 to 80% of my students are working more than 30 hours a week while they're being full-time students, which means that they don't have a lot of disposable income.
Well, and so I think this point kind of moves right into, I think, perhaps the heart, one of the key points of this whole situation is that over the last 50 years, the California State University, which has really been focused at the upper third, but not the top 10%, which goes to the University of California campuses, we have been a means by which minority groups and people who have not come from a highly educated background can get upward mobility into relatively good jobs and into the middle class, etc. So you could almost look at the California State University system as a means of social engineering which promoted the middle class and helped expand the middle class. And I think it's quite possible to look at, you know, the events of the last certainly last decade and see that nationwide there is a trend towards the diminution and the shrinking of the middle class, which is all pervasive and is affecting us from all sides. And this latest series of events at the California State University seems to be just feeding right into that, making it harder and harder for people to reach the middle class and stay there.
I would say that is echoed so precisely. For instance, in our campus president wrote an opinion piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education last week, in which he talked about elitist understandings of education. He very much disparaged the notion that everybody should get a college education. He told us that we need to understand this is not something everybody can get. And I think that flies in the face of exactly the ethos that informs the California State University. One of the things that caused me to stay at this campus for 16 years now is that I get to make a very real difference in people's lives. As Eric says, we deal with first-generation college students. We have disproportionately ethnically minority students. We have disproportionately lower-income students. We really make a difference to these folks.
Do you get the feeling that maybe they're really gearing the higher education out there in that direction?
Yes, I do, because if we look at Dominguez Hills, the other campus on the CSU that's being treated very harshly with respect to budget, we see the same thing. They're urban LA, large proportion of minority, largely African American. In the case of my campus, large minority. We have lots and lots of Hispanic students, a fair number of Indian students, a lot of Assyrian students. And we see it is indeed the minority campuses for one reason or another that tend to be suffering the most from this, whether that's intentional or just an effect of the way the system's structured. You know, it's a matter for debate. But that is the end result of what happens, yes.
Well, we did an interview with Charlotte Iserbay not too long ago, and it seems like, you know, that not just higher education, but education in general seems to be being geared in specific directions and more towards possibly the vocational, and that the higher education may be kind of put out of the hands of even the middle class at some point, but yet you're telling me that possibly it may be, at least for this point in time, a reverse? Am I making that point clear? Are you following me?
Okay. Well, I can barely hear you, Melody, so
okay.
Speak up a little bit.
Okay, what I was saying was that Charlotte Iserbay had brought up the fact that, you know, they're gearing education in more like the vocational direction, and that maybe we are, yet with what we're saying, you're saying with your campus, that they're gearing it towards the minorities, would kind of, unless they're going to change the curricula, I find it kind of interesting that they're the ones that are going to get the support, while unless they're going to split off those that have the money into, you know, the more expensive colleges, and the middle class may be kind of left out.
Well, I think you've got some good points there, but maybe to clarify a little bit, the hands of the curriculum has always been in the hands of the faculty, pretty much. And we have this notion at our university and others of shared governance, in which the decisions on curriculum are mostly determined by the faculty. Well, we have a new regime in the administration now that more or less wants to throw out the idea of shared governance and wants to move the campus radically in a new direction and towards a new definition, which includes more computer courses and I think less full-time tenured faculty and probably more part-time faculty, which of course would save costs from an administrative point of view. In fact, our president was, before he came to our campus, he was president of Chapman College, which is a for-profit college, which mostly is geared towards education majors maybe you can correct me, Steve, on that, but there may be a couple other subjects. But the difference in Chapman is that it's for-profit. There's only 10% tenured faculty. The rest are part-timers, so they save lots of costs. Faculty don't participate much in faculty governance. They don't really do much in terms of research. So it's a kind of a degree factory, diploma mill, if you will, along the lines of Phoenix College. And of course, across the land, there are more and more campuses that are oriented towards computer courses, virtual campuses, et cetera. And so we I think, bottom line, our campus is being pulled in that direction without wanting to be pulled in that direction. Our faculty is not interested in going there because it is a radical departure from the stated mission and values of our, and goals of our campus.
Well, does your does your campus also have much in the way of the military support or corporate support like some of the universities?
No, we are being in the middle of the Central Valley. Up until about 10 years ago, there was a really large Air Force base about 10 miles south of us. Another one about 40 miles north. We had a huge number of military students. Both of those bases were closed in the wave of closures during the 90s. So we don't have a large number of military students because there isn't a place for them to be housed. It's also true that our corporate support is significantly lower than the campuses in the more metropolitan areas, obviously because there's a lot less large industry and certainly fewer very, very wealthy people.
Well, perhaps, Steve, you'd like to get back to my comment.
Yeah, I would like to return to that because one of the really important things we see is that on my campus, one of the things we advertise more than anything else, quoting from the brochure, your classes will be taught by real faculty. One of the things that happens at Chapman, that 10% of the faculty that are tenured that Eric noted, those are the people that write the curriculum. They literally compose the classes. They hand the lecture notes off to the other people. The other people go to a classroom and read the lecture notes to the students. What happens on our campus is the people that write the notes are the ones teaching the classes, which enables us to do a much more customized form of education. I stand in a classroom with my students. I can tell by looking into their eyes when they get things and when they don't. I can work with them to help them get over the rough spots. It's a very, very personalized sort of experience, and one of the things we're being pushed toward now as a function of our leadership and as a function of what they think is a good response to budgeting is a shift away from that toward, as Eric mentioned, this notion of, well, we'll just do things online and you'll be able to serve 100 students instead of 25. And the problem, of course, is that I cannot provide the same sorts of services to 100 students that I can to 25. And that echoes disproportionately at the first-generation college students who need that extra help with what's going on here. Some of the students we get in our classes have no conception of themselves with a college degree. They have no understanding of the basics of education. For instance, I've had more than one student in the last 2 years bring their parent into my office so that I could, please, Professor Fielding, will you tell them I have to do homework? Because their family educational levels are such that nobody in their family has any clue what school is like. They don't have any understanding of why somebody would do homework. They think, you went to school all day, now you come home, you can work. And I find myself trying to explain to people the difference in lifestyle that goes along with education. And that does take work and it does take time. It's not a matter of step out of one mode and into the other. Because it's not just the student that's involved, it's often their entire family.
So back to this idea of shared governance versus governance from the top. What do you see as how is that being played out on our campus?
Well, again, I've stayed here for 16 years. One of the reasons is there's an incredible unanimity across the campus between the faculty, between the staff, between the students, about what we're about. We are about providing opportunity for changing lives to people who probably wouldn't get an opportunity otherwise. And if you talk to almost anybody in our campus, that's what they will tell you we're about. We are faced now with an executive administration who says, well, we need to be entrepreneurial. We need to, quote, get better students, unquote, which seems to be a statement that we need to get people with higher SAT scores. We need to be more entrepreneurial. We need to react to the market. And all of that seems to bind itself upon stop doing what you have been doing. And I find it sometimes very interesting that our president will brag loudly about our six-year graduation rate, which at 50% is significantly higher than most of the other CSUs and a lot of organizations across the nation. In fact, it's so high that several national organizations have sent teams to our campus to investigate how we do so well. But at the same time, he brags about that. He's setting into place motions that are going to destroy precisely that, all in pursuit of a, quote, entrepreneurial university that is less dependent on state support and more dependent on selling whatever the market wants to buy at 8:46 on a Tuesday night.
So you say the business model has, or the corporate model has kind of grabbed our university by the top and is shaking it hard to try to get the whole university to fall in line. Would that be one way to put it?
Yes, it's a lot easier to say, well, we're going to start offering a certificate program in, geographic information systems than it is to say we are going to go and have a conversation with the state legislature and the taxpayers and remind them of why education is worth funding.
Well, hasn't it always been that way, in a sense, with, that our educational system was always geared toward the corporation and the what supports the country type model, but now it sounds like they're trying to make it lean and mean?
Lean and mean in a couple senses. One of those is that one of the things I heard from employers when I graduated from college in the 80s was, we would really like generalists. That is, we would like people from a liberal arts school who have a broadly based education. What we hear from people these days are, we need people with these three skill sets. There seems to be the notion that we can particulate classes so that, for instance, some employers will basically go to the Ivy League schools and hire people with a, quote, liberal arts education, and then they will go to the state schools to hire effectively technicians, people who have been trained in very specific skill sets. It's a way to instill class in the society.
Well, if I could shift gears, and I know we need to come back to these, but let's talk about the plight of our state for a minute. The excuse or the reason given for these, draconian cuts and changes is that the state is broke and that we're in debt. Now, as I remember a couple of years ago, people saying that California by itself, in comparison with the nations of the world, would have the fifth largest economy in the world. I think maybe we're down to number seven. Is that correct, Steve?
Seven or eight these days, I think.
Yeah, seven or eight these days. So, yeah, California is having some difficult times. Obviously, the housing industry is down. You know, businesses are leaving. Tourism is down. California is having a hard time. But and I guess we're about, what, $28 billion in debt. Is that correct?
Well, depends on which day of the week and who you talk to. A big amount, definitely.
Well, as I recall, we were like $40 billion in debt when Enron built the state by creating artificial energy shortages under Gray Davis right around the beginning of the Bush administration. And the Bush administration, of course, didn't step in to help put price caps on energy, thus helping their buddies in Enron. And we went from a $40 billion surplus in the early part of Gray Davis's term as governor to a $40 billion deficit due to, you know, the rolling blackouts and the energy shortages. And at that point, the state borrowed heavily, I think the entire amount, from banks in order to pay off the criminally delinquent energy companies who had created these artificial shortages. So for some reason, with a $40 billion deficit in 2001, California could borrow the money to pay off the debt, but for some reason in 2009 that option is not available to our Governor Schwarzenegger. What's the deal here?
That's a volitional choice. Obviously, there have been a lot of stories in the press about California's rating with the major debt agencies, and it's gone down. It's pretty low. In fact, it's low enough that the CSU's debt rating is higher than the state of California's, ostensibly because we manage money better. But it's a little unclear to me what it means for a government to say we're in debt or we're in the hole. It seems to me the purpose of government is to provide services for the populace, and it provides those services, it acquires the resources to do so from the populace, and as in any organization, it has to make investments. So if we look at what happened in the 60s, the master plan for education in California produced a huge crop of college graduates. Arguably, that's the single most important factor that produced the California economic boom for so many years. If that's a compelling story, then what's going on right now is that we are literally cutting our arm off. That is, we are seriously constraining the number of college graduates we're going to produce. We're constraining the number of smart people able to react effectively to the outside environment. Studies done in the last year suggest that we're going to be facing a woeful shortage of college graduates. Even if things kept going as they were 2 years ago, we'd be facing a shortage. What's going to happen now is we're going to face a very dire shortage of educated people. So it is indeed the educated people that produce the income, that produce the increases in value that fund the education for the future.
Yeah, we know people like Grover Norquist of the think tank Americans for Tax Reform back in D.C., a very, very Republican think tank associated with the Bush administration, have made statements like, in 20 years I'd like to see government shrink down so small that I can drown it in a bathtub. And, of course, that ideology would say we have to cut all funding for social programs that will benefit the public. And in other words, we'll just keep money concentrated in the hands of the very few, the very rich. And our own governor, Governor Schwarzenegger, was quoted on the cover of the California Faculty Association a couple of years saying, we've got to starve the beast. And, again, that same ideology in his comment, the beast refers to the people. So this very, very Republican ideology is that the wealth should be only concentrated in the hands of the extremely wealthy. They're the only ones who deserve wealth, and everybody else deserves poverty, I guess.
And part of the way they got that wealth was with use of the public services that were available when they were there. A disproportionate number of the state legislature and the people that staff the state legislature offices are graduates of the CSU. The understanding seems to be, okay, I've got my education, but I don't want to pay for anybody else's. So I've got mine. You guys go get yours somewhere else.
So we went from altruism in the 60s to greed in the 90s and early 2000s. Would you say that that's the kind of the pendulum swing here?
Well, I'm not sure that I'd call it altruism. I might call it well-informed self-interest, because I think pretty clearly everybody in California, Lord knows the people that had real estate in California in the 70s and 80s saw huge increases in their wealth over the next 20 years. The people and businesses in California saw huge increases in wealth. The people who were working for wages saw huge increases in wages. So you could very easily say that this is people acting in their own self-interest, just having a little bit of a longer-term perspective about it than the people that are saying, no, I don't want to pay, I'm not sure what, 1% more taxes to enable somebody else to get a college degree.
Yeah.
Are there some group or significant leadership there in California that seems to be running this particular cycle? And how is the faculties feel they can fend it off?
I think one large group would be the Howard Jarvis Foundation, which, again, named after the Proposition 13 author, the notion that we can, by ballot mandate, demand that people do or do not do things with money. I think how the people at my institution and other CSUs, and indeed probably the UC as well, try to deal with this is try very hard to educate our students about what education does in a society. I have a colleague who's an economist who did a recent, I think a couple years ago, he did a study of our local area, determines that my university, which has an annual budget at that time of about $70-80 million, is routinely contributing close to $200 million a year into the local economy if you start to figure in the increase in taxes that comes from the increased wages that people that are educated make. I think you can make very sensible arguments that would appeal to capitalists of whatever stripe.
Yeah.
You have to get beyond that first inertial barrier of, I have money in my pocket right now, I don't want to give you any.
Yeah, I think we also should perhaps look at the larger context in the sense of this way we're doing democracy in California with ballot initiatives. Some millionaire in Orange County puts a ballot initiative in the middle of Governor Gray Davis's term, you know, suggesting that we take him out of office, you know, because we don't like him. Well, the state constitution says, you know, you can't do that unless a governor has committed a crime. Well, Gray Davis never committed a crime. His only crime was holding the bag when Enron cheated the state out of billions of dollars and other energy companies, and trying to, in good faith, fix the problem. By the way, he had a $10 billion suit against Enron and the other energy companies to try to get that money back to the state of California. Well, this initiative comes along, and some millionaire got it pushed through, and then they had many, many candidates come forth, and lo and behold, we wind up with our gubernator, Governor Schwarzenegger. And this is, I think, a form of a coup d'etat, because the constitutional law was broken. The governor, who had committed no crime, was taken out in the middle of his term. And, of course, when Schwarzenegger got into power, suddenly that $10 billion lawsuit was just kind of disappeared. So the state never recovered that $10 billion that it perhaps could and should have. So there's all kinds of political intrigue that is going and setting the stage for this current budget crisis. One of our campus leaders talked about the sucker punch from Wall Street. I mean, obviously this is a Wall Street contrivance, this whole budget, this whole crisis nationally. So, the ballot initiative as a way to determine how a state governs itself is pretty crazy, especially nowadays when these initiatives are so complex, the average person can't even figure out what is being proposed. But I say that just to set the stage that there's these shortfalls, these budget shortfalls, often fit a political agenda. And the typical, at least for the last 10, 20 years, Republican agenda has been to take money out of social services, i.e. education and health care and roads and national park, and put it back in the hands of the rich in the form of tax cuts, etc. Okay, well,
yeah.
Steve, did you have a comment about what that little diatribe I just made, or just to basically agree?
Yeah.
What?
I think one of the things that, for instance, the labor movement in California is attempting to do, in a sense, to, I guess you could call it, fight back against the notion of constantly decreasing social services, is to try to establish revenue sources for specifically education. One example of that, a Assembly Bill, AB 656, suggests that we have a severance tax, as most other states do, that is, a tax on the amount of oil taken out of the ground. And the proposal, in summary, basically would generate somewhere between one and multiple billions of dollars a year that would be used strictly to fund education. Now, naturally, the major global corporations that generate millions of dollars in profits daily from extracting oil from beneath our state aren't all that interested in paying taxes. But in one sense, that's a very reactive strategy, right? We say, okay, you're not going to let us raise taxes, so we're going to do something on a specific activity and isolate that money for this purpose, rather in the vein of what Proposition 98 did, try to set money aside to do anti-tobacco, anti-smoking education. what we saw is lots and lots of dollars accumulating and basically not much of a way to spend them, which sort of neatly allied to something you mentioned earlier, federal stimulus money, which is thrown out in an attempt to get the economy started. And at least I've been to several conferences in my area with some of my students looking at what goes on with federal stimulus funds, and what I see at the conferences is sort of a feeding frenzy of the corporate world trying to gobble up those federal resources and effectively becomes subsidized capitalism. So we put out resources to stimulate the economy. The corporations acquire those resources, and rather than extending their activities, they use those resources to fund what they would have had to fund themselves anyway. So the net result is the economy does not get the bounce that we think it should.
Yeah, but the top 1% of the top wealthiest percent of America gets that bounce. Is that more or less?
Oh, yeah. I think pretty clearly, if you look at, for instance, statistics from the IRS, one of the things you'll note is that income disparity between top one-tenth of 1%, top 5%, and the rest of the population has reached levels that have only been seen before right about 1929. And that is a trend we see continuing despite the drastic downturn in the value of the market. In other words, people may have been hurt, but people with enough resources not to have to depend on selling the investments they have that decrease in value are still generating immense amounts of return on their investments.
Well, I kind of also want to just bring up the fact that I know we're, again, talking about California, but I really do think that it's going to be, if it isn't indicative of the rest of the country yet, I believe it will be.
Oh, I think it's clearly in the rest of the country. In fact, it's so far in the rest of the country that some state universities have now started referring to themselves as state-assisted rather than state universities. They have managed to get so much of their funding from other sources, that, which, of course, gives them a great freedom of action, because once they get money from someplace other than the state, they no longer feel bound by what the state thinks they should do.
So do you see the vision of this present administration at our campus to move us towards the Chapman model, the model that would pull in money, say, from university extended education funds, which are non-state, what implications then would it have for our campus if that vision were implemented? What further implications?
What I see in my campus is we have a president who loves to talk about being entrepreneurial and urge other people to do it, but I don't believe has very much experience in the world of the entrepreneurial. In the same sense that Dick Cheney loves to talk about decisive military action without ever actually experiencing any. And I think that's an important point, because when people who have no experience start prating loudly about this is the way you need to go, I think perhaps their prating should be viewed with some suspicion. I can certainly understand a need to respond to the market for my university, which I think is a need for higher education. I'm much less sure that we need to be adding majors, deleting majors, changing programs because of what somebody thinks they want to take this week. That is, I think education is a much longer term market than what comes off in a survey this month or next month or what an employer says they want Tuesday afternoon.
Go ahead.
I think as we try to shift toward that model of meeting immediate demand, that we, if you will, try to engage in sort of a Max Headroom-esque immediate response to public demand, what we see is we're going to get really hamstrung by the fact that the public demand doesn't involve a real awareness of what we offer.
Well, we're hearing a lot about technology, you know, and globalization and being competitive and entrepreneurial, and we're seeing a lot of emphasis, at least from our administration, on trying to get professors to teach courses online. Now, most of us certainly relatively old guys like you and myself, and I'm older than you, we grew up with the concept of a liberal education. We had college was a part of our social development. It was we knew our professors. We saw them. We were in small classrooms with them. We had the idea that if we could develop this ability to critically think, to learn for ourselves, that we could indeed pursue learning. We'd be equipped then to pursue learning throughout our life. We'd learn to think critically. I guess in education parlance, that's called the affective domain, whereas the simply learning rote facts, like on electrical wiring or something, would be a cognitive domain. And cognitive domain would be considered the lowest level of learning. And yet it seems to me that if we do move towards a lot of computer classes, we're mostly going to be kind of emphasizing cognitive domain kinds of skills. And if you're going to take a course in electrical wiring, yeah, why not do it online? But if you're going to have a course that involves critical thinking or wants to promote critical thinking, it's harder for me to see how that's going to happen online, and it's harder for me to see how students are going to become socialized. If a kid is growing up learning in front of a computer all his life, at some point he needs to get out and deal with people and learn how to deal with people. What do you think about that?
Well, I think there's a constant debate on my campus and on most campuses in the country now about the notion of online education. It's perceived as a really quick fix to a problem. We're not, if we do online education, according to president of my campus, we need a computer, we need a faculty member of one stripe or another to sit at the computer, and that's all we need. We don't need a classroom, we don't need parking lots, we don't need any of that stuff. The problem with that is, well, first, in the reality, the probably close to half of the students in the online classes we offer right now are taking a class online from their dorm room. That is, a disproportionate number are people that are already attending the school and just take the class online because they don't want to change clothes out of their pajamas, because that's the only class they can get, a wide variety of reasons. But we don't see, for instance, people from the rest of the country, let alone the rest of the planet, flocking to CSU Stanislaus website to do that. Another reality is that it's hard to do. I actually teach online classes occasionally, and I struggle desperately with them. I don't think we know how to do online learning very effectively right now. As I mentioned, it's easy to figure out how to do online, learn some facts. It's very difficult how to do online learning of how to do critical analyses.
Now, has this model been in higher education been tried and accomplished, or in other countries, and has it had some, you know, not so positive ramifications? Are you aware of such a thing?
I think the most compelling statement I could make about that, when I was a child in the 60s, there was a show called Sunrise Semester on the television every morning at 6 a.m. where you could take a college class by one-way TV. If it was that effective, I wouldn't be teaching at a university right now. Everybody would be doing it. You can make claims that there are some places in the UK where they try very hard with online education. There are places in Australia, certainly in the outback, where people are getting class by radio, by network, by whatever they can get it. But as on a large scale, no. I don't think there is anywhere that's built a successful large-scale operation. What it seems to be is a piecemeal technology that works when we can't make the way we do things normally work. And it doesn't produce the same effect. If we talk to our students about online classes, we notice that they inevitably will say it's more convenient. They also will inevitably have some serious questions about whether they learned as much as they would have if they were in a classroom.
So in other words, you're saying that, you know, since it isn't, you'd have to wonder why they would be keep pushing towards this particular model unless they're just trying to choke out education.
choke out education, and certainly choke out the dollars of education, because, again, there's a notion that if I'm in a classroom, I'll be able to tell if there's more than 25 students there, whereas If I'm doing it online, somehow I won't be able to tell. And since there isn't a need for seats, we can do a lot more. What research tells us is that if you're going to do online classes, you best think about a maximum number of students of about 25, unless you want to do one-way, I'm just going to lecture at you instruction. It takes a lot more time.
And who's to say John is really in the class? Let's say you've got a student who signs up and his name is John. I mean, you never see him, I suppose. It could be Joe, who's John's smarter friend. Is that happening?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the reasons why concomitant with lots of the stories about online education comes a rise in a new type of business called testing facility. That is a place that will contract with, for instance, CSU Stanislaus, that faculty can say, I'm going to have an exam on such and such a date. Students go to that place, wherever it is, and take the exam, so that there's supposedly some assurance that it is indeed John taking John's exam and not his best friend Jeff.
Okay. Well, we're also hearing shifts in you know, buzzwords and terminology, and one of the shifts that some of us have picked up on is students are sometimes now referred to as clients. I think this is perhaps problematic because the implication is that if the student doesn't pass the class, you as the teacher haven't served your client's interests. And it takes the onus off of the student to actually perform and do the work and learn something. Then it would seem to me that this might drive the whole system to the point where, you know, it's almost a hollow shell. You could go through the motions without learning much at all.
Yes, I think it's akin to saying that people that go into a physician's office are customers. I mean, in one sense, okay, there is some kind of a transaction going on there. But customers implies some things that I don't think a lot of us would be very comfortable with. People don't really understand what they're buying. They don't really have a way of judging what they're buying. One of the assignments I give my MBA students is to develop an outcomes assessment system for their class. That is, figure out what they should measure to determine whether they actually got something of value there. Where most of them end up is, well, you need to talk with me 5 years later and 10 years later and 20 years later.
Mm.
And that's just probably not a really effective mechanism because it's going to take 20 years to figure out whether you did something right or not.
Maybe that's why we spend so much time spinning our wheels about this magic word assessment, because it is so very, very difficult to do.
Right. We're trying very hard to find some way to say to the public, we produce value. See, here's a measure of it.
When, in fact, it may not be possible.
Well, it's clear that we can measure some things. So, for instance, in the business college where I teach, every couple years we give our students exit exam, and then we look at their exams and correlate them with exams for other universities and what's in our classes and make some assumptions about what they learned and what they didn't learn. But at most, we can ask them, you know, 50, 100 questions. That's a really poor proxy for 3 or 4 years worth of learning.
Yeah.
And it misses the point. It says, here's some facts I know. It doesn't say, I've learned how to analyze the world critically and profit from what I learned.
Yeah, I have a good friend who years ago gave me a book called The Hidden Harvest, and it's directed towards teachers, and of course implicit in the title is the idea that, you know, the results are not immediately apparent. Your students will benefit perhaps on down the line, but there may not be short-term benefits that are very easy to measure. Yeah, so...
Those may not be the important benefits. Frankly, I think if what I'm teaching my graduate students is stuff that they're going to benefit from in the next 6 months, I'm probably not doing my job. I think I should be preparing them for what happens to them 5 and 10 years out.
So what are you going to, what are your projections of what's taking place? And do you have any kind of answers if, you following me?
I wish I had answers. My projections are that this debate is going to intensify because I think what we're seeing right now is a real constriction in the availability of higher ed after our society has spent most of the last, well, effectively since World War II, advertising to everybody in our society that the way to get ahead is to get an education. The route to the middle class is through college. The route to the upper class is through graduate school. We have really, really successfully sold people on that notion. And when we come across now and say, oh, well, sorry, don't have any room, you know, not everybody needs a college education, people quite understandably feel as if you're telling them you don't get to move to the middle class or you don't get to move to the upper class. And they feel cheated and they get angry. And I think what we're seeing, I hope, in the next couple of years is a focus of that anger to the point that people start developing a conception again of public goods. That is, they start to see the value in, for instance, in California, funding abused children's centers so that they don't have to read really ugly stories in the newspaper, so that they see the value of funding higher ed, even if their child is not at the age where they would be in college, because they start understanding that, you know, I might have kids that aren't going to go to college that I fund, but I am going to become elderly in this society, and I'm probably going at some point to need health care, and it would really be neat if the nurses had been educated in biochemistry. You know, yeah, again, I think it's an enlightened self-interest argument.
Yeah. If we project, however, the present trend at our university cutting more classes, laying off more professors, having more part-time instructors, having less faculty governance or faculty participation in shared governance, having less of an emphasis on faculty research, this again is all going to be moving towards streamlining the profit-making potential of the university, but downsizing the expectations of our students so that their abilities then to get better jobs and to think critically, et cetera, would not be as strong. So would you see this then as a kind of a slow motion or maybe even a fast motion way to kind of take down the American economy or the California economy?
Yes. I think what we're seeing is an attempt to do to the university system what was done to the K-12 system. Push more students in, have a focus on mechanisms of accountability, that is, standardized tests that don't actually measure very much. And I think what we'll see over the next 10 or 15 years, if this trend continues, is a significant lowering in the abilities of people to think analytically, which I firmly believe is what college is really about.
Thomas Jefferson said, people who would like to be ignorant and free in a civilization want what has never been and what can never be. And essentially, you have to have an educated population if you're going to have a democracy that's functional. If, however, you don't have a functional democracy, then you can deal with slaves and serfs quite well if they don't think critically. So perhaps what we're moving toward is more of a feudalistic system where the vast majority of people are supposed to be a worker class and are not supposed to share in the wealth and the spoils of the society. Is this kind of where you see we're going?
Yes, I mean, we're seeing a rise in, as Foucault would put it, the need for obedient and calculable individuals. That is, we're seeing, I think if we look at what went on during the Bush administration, there's a really nice microcosm of that. There's a real antithetical approach to questioning. We don't want you to question. If you're asking questions, you must be against us. Do what we say. And I see the same sorts of things happening with respect to education, the attempt to produce the obedient populace. And the problem with that is that the obedient populace is only capable of doing what you tell it to, which means whoever you is had better have a really good grasp of what needs to be done.
Who do you think's pushing this agenda? I mean, obviously it has to be an agenda of sorts. I mean, or it wouldn't be so widespread, correct?
I would given my own political ideologic bent, I would probably ascribe a lot of that to a flawed understanding of the capitalist model. The notion that there's this thing called a market that can determine the value of anything, and that value is best expressed in little green pictures of dead presidents.
Yeah,
I think, you know, what Habermas referred to as the economization of the life world. We tend to want to translate everything we do into dollars, so that when, for instance, I work with the homeless community in the town our university is related in, people will talk about how much are you spending in dollars and how much are you saving in dollars. And I have, frankly, no way to quantify in dollar amounts the value of somebody not having to sleep in a gutter. Now, I can make a pretty compelling argument by saying, let me turn this into dollars for you. If somebody sleeps in the gutter often, they're likely to have to go to the hospital twice. Here's the amount that would be spent on the emergency room if they were there. And it turns out that as an economic argument, that's actually pretty compelling, but it leaves aside a lot of the other issues, that is, the human issues. And that is, to me, the horror of what we see going on. There is a serious reduction in the ability of all of us to understand the humanness of others.
Well, I guess I could expand on that a little bit. You know, J.D. Rockefeller, the guy who monopolized the oil markets back in 1870, and his family is supposed to have had a very key role in determining future policy for the entire country, because these monopoly cartels were so powerful. This is the age of the robber barons. He said,
right,
competition is sin. So his understanding of capitalism was that cartels would form monopolies, and they would destroy the competition, and they would become then the ruling class. So I think what we have today is a return of the robber barons, and of course they say that capitalism can easily harden into fascism, which is just capitalism with guns and willing to kill people, and of course fascism is also when corporations and government are you know, intertwined so much they really can't be separated. And in that sense, I think we've had a fascist government now for quite a while. By that definition, corporatocracy, where corporations really rule the roost. We've got, 47,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C. that are representing their interests to our representatives, and the American public is not getting their voice heard above those corporate voices by the money, the small green pictures with dead men on them, as you say. We have a great system, we have a great constitution, but it's unfortunately fairly easy to co-opt and to control by a fairly small group of very, very powerful people who know the techniques of propaganda and control of the media and control of politicians. So where are the American people in this? Well, the American people need to assert themselves in democratic fora, as a plural of forums, and they need to try to take back the democracy that is guaranteed to us, but I think we're in trouble. And of course, if we lose a populace, if these educational changes continue, and the number of individuals capable of critical thinking continues to decline, then it's more or less it's going to be much harder to reclaim the ownership of America by for and of the people.
What would you say
right.
What would you say to the model, though, or the possible trend that's going on in other aspects of our society of them privatizing or making these public-private partnerships in our universities, or actually selling them off to maybe foreign entities or whatever? Do you foresee anything like that?
It's already happening. One of my interests has to do with a strange form of privatization. What happens when, for instance, the city you live in decides that we need to have some industry, a very common notion these days. What we see happening, for instance, when Foster Farms wants to put another chicken processing plant somewhere, there is competition among various cities trying to get them to locate their production facility there in pursuit of jobs for the population. And we see most probably famously with respect to Walmart, who really exploits this, cities willing to give literally millions of dollars in tax benefits and freebies to organizations to get them to locate a facility in that community. What we see typically is in very, 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 very few cases does the community come out ahead. The organization will move there, take advantage of the millions of dollars in tax rebates, and leave. And Walmart has a long, long checkered history of this. That's one mechanism for that blending of the public and the private. Another mechanism is literally to sell things off. So that, for instance, a lot of colleges now will have, you know, the John J. Jones College of Business named after so-and-so. They will have faculty chairs positions named after people. They will sell off the rights to do education outside the university, which we actually do, and it's called extended education. It's a little profit-making center in the midst of the university that uses state resources but creates revenue that isn't subject to the rules around how we spend revenue. Naturally, the people in control of the organization like that. So it's a unique form of privatization that enables people that ostensibly work for the public to have non-public controlled pools of assets, which they can do with as they please. And I think that trend is continuing, sadly.
Yeah. Well, if we go down the road with the present configuration in our administration. Before we do that, let's just talk about the turnovers we've seen at our campus a little bit, Steve. What's been going on in the last 5 years, say, that this new president has come in terms of turnovers in the administration, and how top-heavy are we now?
I think, you know, some background on that. Our president has been on our campus. This will be his fifth year. In that period of time, he has had five different vice presidents of development, which is fundraising and publicity, four different vice presidents of academic affairs, that is the instructional side of the house, four different vice presidents for business and finance, the people to keep track of things. We have had probably almost as much turnover as your local McDonald's in administrative staff. We've also seen in that five-year period, a growth in the number of management staff we have. And what's perhaps even more distressing, not only a growth in the number of staff, but a growth, I think the last time I looked, it was 25% growth in the amount of money we're paying for management staff, which means that as we get more students, rather than acquiring more teachers, rather than acquiring more staff to help the students get financial aid or do their transcripts, we're acquiring more people who watch the teachers and watch the staff work, which seems less than an efficient mechanism. Now, the argument typically made by the administration is, well, there are lots of rules that the federal government applies. In other words, we have to follow some rules to be able to dispense federal financial aid. There are lots of rules that the state of California has that require us to report information to them. And their story is that, well, every time they add another report, we have to hire another assistant vice president to do that report. I sound skeptical about that because from what I've watched, it isn't actually the vice presidents that prepare the reports. It is the faculty and the staff that prepare the reports.
Yeah, that's what I notice is that so many of these administrators come on and then they give their work to the faculty who are already overworked. And, of course, what we've seen this year is we're all taking a 10% pay cut, which is commensurate with our furlough days. We're supposed to take 2 days off a month. But we're also asked to teach more classes. So, in a sense, we're working harder, getting paid less. Our students are paying more, and, of course, they're getting less. So what we're looking at is kind of a Walmart downsizing kind of or a corporate downsizing model. How many assistant vice presidents do we have at our campus now?
I believe we have four real vice presidents and I think eight flavors of assistant associate vice president, which is a fairly significant number of people for an operation our size.
So
we are, I believe, right about Yeah, there are about 100 what defined as management personnel on our campus.
So are these people pretty much kind of hired to go in and kind of like start streamlining as much and cutting out as much as they can and discouraging the morale in what they're doing?
There's a very clear correlation there. What we've seen is a lot of task shifting, a lot of cost shifting, that is finding ways to bill students additionally for things. Oh, you want to use a check to pay for your tuition? Well, that'll be an extra $25. You would like to do it in person? That's an extra $10. That sort of thing goes on. And we see lots in terms of finding ways to get people to do more. Although, as Eric says, we're also charging our students, again, 32% more this fall. We're offering 100 fewer classes. There are a little over 100 fewer faculty on the campus. There are a few less staff, which sometimes in my more pessimistic moments makes me ponder why it is we need more managers to manage fewer people.
And these managers are coming in getting high salaries. Is that not correct?
Oh, sure. We talked about the budget game earlier, where your first impulse when you get a budget cut is to say, well, I'm going to remove the thing that you need the most. We see sort of a concomitant game with administrative wages. Every time we hire someone in, we have to pay probably 10 to 20% more so that, quote, we get the best person, unquote. And when they leave, that happens again. And once one of them comes in, then all the other assistant vice presidents will say, hey, that person's getting paid that much. You have to pay me this much, too. It's an ever ratcheting up game that works very similarly to what people get so annoyed about with respect to the investment banks on Wall Street.
So what is the reason for all these turnovers?
You know, I've seen this model take place quite a bit in all other aspects of anywhere from, you know, I'd work in nursing homes or in factories and that sort of thing, and I watch them. They end up playing the employees off each other one way or another, whether it's through management or the like. And yes, you do get a higher turnover that way, and then we'll bring in people that will be paid a large wage that may be just traveling. And before you know it, you know, the whole system has been turned upside down.
Right. And it's a short-term strategy, because what it does over time and what we have seen on our campus is that the staff that are the most competent, the staff that are easily able to get another job, do exactly that. The faculty start thinking, I don't really want to be in a place like this. And they start leaving. So we start seeing a migration of the people that can migrate easily. And what's left is people that, I don't know, can accustom themselves to working in a not very nice environment, people that, for whatever reason, can't go somewhere else. And you see the morale of the campus start to diminish. And as morale goes down, people get crankier. As people get crankier, they get angrier at each other. And, you know, I think, Melody, you mentioned something earlier about management pitting people against each other. We have seen a master at work at that on our campus for the last 2 years. We have gone from a situation where the faculty and staff routinely would host picnics together for the employees, would make a point of doing everything together, now to the point that the staff, at least some of the staff, have been, I don't know how else to say it, romanced by the president of the institution, to the point that they now feel that the faculty are their enemies, which means that I think in a very real sense our students suffer, because a lot of times the faculty and staff are busy trying to find ways to work with each other rather than just spending the time doing the work.
Well, we had a very dramatic faculty meeting at the beginning of the semester, It lasted, I think, over 3 hours. A number of people gave talks. And could you just recap a little bit of what that was about, Steve?
Sure. And, well, the nascence of that meeting was the discovery that as I took office as Speaker of the Faculty, the Chair of the Faculty Senate for the year, I
probably not too surprisingly, talked with the people who had had that office for the last 5 years, asking them for their counsel, what I should try to do, what I should avoid. And what started to bubble out of that conversation was that there are serious problems with the chief executive at our organization. And we did sort of a look over the summer at how things had worked with him and discovered that we seemed to have spent the first 2 years he was here trying to get along and accepting things he said on faith. The third and fourth years he was here trying to get along and being ignored. And this year sort of, I guess, almost moving into the institutional warfare stage. So that today at the Academic Senate meeting, we spent an hour and a half discussing the notion of having the faculty issue a vote of no confidence in the president, which is sort of the academic way of saying we have no confidence in your ability to lead our organization. And a lot of that is based around his demonstrated unwillingness to use the mission of our institution as a primary guiding force for decisions that are made. And I can't express how deeply it distresses me to have to say that in public.
Well, as I recall, that was a very dramatic, and I think it's another story, the vote of no confidence, or the discussion of the vote of no confidence that occurred today in the faculty meeting or the faculty senate. But at the meeting I'm talking about in early September, as I recall, we had no press coverage of that, and there were no stories in the wider community about the kind of relative turmoil and level of the ruffled feelings and difficult times were not reflected in the press. And can you tell me why there was no press coverage of say
sure.
the faculty side?
I think there is no coverage of that for a very good reason. The faculty avoided it. And the reason they avoided it, I think, is that all of us here have a very deep commitment to this institution. And one of the things we constantly are in fear of is harming the institution. We don't want people to think bad thoughts about our institution. We don't want to be in a negative press. We want people to come to our campus. We want them to send their kids. We'd really like them to donate money to us. We want to be a productive part of the community. And for a lot of us, there's a real strong aversion to airing our dirty laundry, if you will, in public. Now, I have to confess that coming from a more corporate organizational background, my inclination is to be much more open about it and say, hey, you know what? We did some dumb stuff. The good side of that is we learned from it and we won't do it anymore. But that's a really difficult conversation for a lot of people to have. They don't want the community to think bad things about our school.
Well, at this particular meeting, a faculty meeting I'm talking about, a number of faculty who were involved in various committees like the University Budget Advisory Committee, et cetera, gave talks. And one of those talks indicated that three other campuses of our California State University had also gone ahead and made issued votes of no confidence in their presidents. And so it would seem then that, you know, maybe to some extent these problems are systemic or system-wide. And my question is, what effect does that have in terms of affecting change on campus?
The
vote of no
confidence.
The vote
of
no confidence.
Well, historically, votes of no confidence arise from, as so much else, the British parliamentary model. They were a mechanism for expressing a lack of confidence in the leadership to accomplish the stated goals. It wasn't intended to be a list of, here's five things you did wrong, rather a statement that we don't believe that you can do this job effectively. So, in one sense, it's sort of legitimate and illegitimate at the same time. The significance of it for most universities is that in large part the administration of a university achieves legitimacy by their relation with the faculty. It is, frankly, the faculty that people come to see. It is the teachers that bring people to the university. When the administration and the faculty are on the outs, by and large, over the long term, it is the faculty that control what goes on. This is one mechanism they have for saying, we think we have a serious problem here. Now, to be completely forthcoming, one of the other faculty members and I went to Long Beach, where the system office is housed, in September, and talked with the chancellor of the entire system and told him that we thought we had some serious problems on our campus and walked through them with him. And not perhaps too surprisingly, I think what resulted was a circling of the wagons. That is an expression by the chancellor that, well, of course, you know, our president is doing a good job, and I have confidence in him. And indeed, that's what we saw at the other campuses that did votes of no confidence. So they are not mechanisms that will cause somebody to, you know, call up the president and say, well, you don't have a job tomorrow. They are effective mechanisms in terms of inducing institutional change. And if you look over a two-year period, you will see a significant cycling of executive personnel after a vote of no confidence occurs.
Can I just throw something in here? Because what I'm seeing and hearing from what you're talking about, it again, to me, is a bigger picture of how they're letting you guys devour yourselves and try to work out problems that aren't under your anything that you would do would be roadblocked. Because ultimately, there's a much bigger picture taking place here, and just the fact that the state of California is being put into the financial distress that it is exactly what's being done to the whole country. And until we start backing up and realizing we're being played and manipulated, and that's what's going to happen to you as long as you guys are trying to solve problems that really they've created, but created for reasons that they're not being open about. Are you following what I'm saying?
I think you're entirely right. And, you know, a really good picture of that is what's happening not only in California, but in a lot of other states as well. People are told, look, the state has this much money, so either we don't fund health care, or we don't fund social services, or we don't fund education, or we don't fund the police department, and we force people to make unpalatable choices rather than shifting the decisions. And it is precisely the point at which I think we shift decisions that things start to change, when the public says, okay, I don't think it's acceptable to have to choose between being able to live because I've got health care and being able to get a job because I've been educated. Public needs to say there has to be another choice there. I shouldn't have to choose between those two things.
Well, we kind of have to kind of step back and start looking at these corporations and those that are governing this country and planet, and realize that they've got another agenda going on, and as long as they can create discourse and us fighting among each other or trying to figure out answers to problems that they create that aren't really problems but their creation, then we're going to keep chasing our tail.
Right, and a good place to start with that would be the bizarre notion resting upon a law clerk's notes that a corporation has all the rights that a person has.
Yes.
With no morality.
Exactly. A lot of what I teach in my ethics classes has to do with precisely that. We claim that corporations are people under the law, however, we can't lock them up. We certainly can't expect them to have any ethical or moral fiber, and they make remarkable mechanisms by which people can behave very, very badly and never, pardon the phrase, suffer the consequences.
Right, and
that needs to change. We need to return to what corporations were regulated like over 100 years ago, where you set up a corporation, it's for a very stated, specific purpose, and there are very severe limits on what you can do. And in some cases, the livelihood of a corporation, its continued existence, would be reviewed every 20 to 40 years. Effectively, now we've created a class of the population called corporation that is effectively immortal, that has no moral fiber whatsoever, and as a shark, must consume to live.
Right. And as long as we exonerate these guys that are the meanest and the baddest and have no no thought about the people that they devour in that path, then that's what we're going to get. And
yeah, of course, there's an excellent video called The Corporation, and the point that it makes is that, okay, we've given them the legal rights of personhood, the Bill of Rights rights, you know, freedom of speech and et cetera, freedom from searches and seizures. If they are indeed a person, what kind of a person are they? And then they go through the psychological profile and come to find out that based on the behavior of corporations, they fit the ideal description of a psychopath.
Right, and now they're the ones running our school system and our countries.
That's right.
And to me, you're right. That is the point at which privatization goes seriously awry, when we have a psychopath in charge of educating our children, and a psychopath in charge of our health care, and a psychopath in charge of providing our police protection.
So could we agree here, Melody and Steve, to revoke the rights of personhood to corporations? I certainly would agree. But now making it happen would probably be problematic, because they have so much enormous power in the government. They have so many resources. But if the American people ever really got organized on that, I suppose it's possible that we could rescind the rights of personhood to corporations, right?
And I think there are chipping away as you can do with that. I have a colleague in the UK who writes with me occasionally, and one of the things we talk about is the nature of how corporations are accountable to the rest of society. A major vector there is financial statements, which are all supposed to be audited by somebody like me, a certified public accountant. Oddly, though, the CPA that audits the financial statement is paid by the corporation whose books he audits. That seems
conflict of interest.
Yes. So one argument might be that we need to move the auditing profession to the government, where perhaps it would pay less well, but which might achieve some objectivity, and that might help rein in some of the excesses of the corporate behavior.
Well, of course, and the whole purpose of government can and should be to regulate the excesses of business. But what we've seen, of course, over the last several decades is this thing called the revolving door, where the corporate masters rotate into positions of power in government, like Dick Cheney, former head of Halliburton, who's our recent Treasury Secretary? All these guys are Goldman Sachs CEOs. Geithner and Paul, what's his name, the bald guy.
Volcker.
Not Volcker, but the guy who was presiding
Bernanke?
Over TARP. Not Bernanke, the Treasury Secretary.
Hank Paulson?
Yeah, Henry Paulson.
Okay.
These guys are CEOs of Goldman Sachs, which is an investment bank here. And, of course, they came out of the financial crisis stronger than ever because they got their people in government. So what we see now is government being run by the very same people who run the corporations. They just go back and forth
and
change positions.
And these guys come out of the same business schools, and so they're getting the same model to set them up to run these corporations. And this is, again, comes back to the higher education aspect. And holding these guys accountable until we stand up and start doing that, then is it going to trickle down to being able to have states that actually run with some fiscal responsibility and being able to have our lifestyle come back again?
Yeah, one of the things I saw when I practiced accounting made the situation very clear to me. One of my clients got audited by the IRS. Here comes an IRS GS-14 who makes about, at that time, $32,000 a year, buys his own suits and carries a briefcase. He's going into an office. The partner of the firm walks into the partner's office. The partner sitting there makes $500,000 a year. He sits behind a desk that costs more than this IRS agent makes in the course of a year. It became very clear to me where the balance is in that equation. If organizations have the money to hire smart accountants and lawyers, they can pretty well determine what they pay or don't pay to the government. They can certainly determine how to take advantage of the rule sets all of us live by in ways that you and I and all the other normal people on the planet have no chance of doing.
Yeah. Well, back, we only have a little bit of time left. If we could come back to our immediate situation, we have, sure. I think, a gubernatorial election coming up about this time next year. And the potential then, I think Jerry Brown is making moves. Perhaps he might run as a Democratic candidate, and, of course, he has a lot of name recognition. There's a good possibility, I suppose, that we might have a Democratic governor. In that case, would we perhaps expect money to flow back into education enough so that we could see the kind of California State University that we've known kind of reconstitute itself, or do you think the damage may be so thoroughly implemented already that we will forever be changed, which of course is the stated goal of our president in his letter to the Chronicle of Higher Education?
My sense is that in California, as in Colorado and elsewhere, I think there is a strong move towards what goes by the name of the Democratic Party in our nation. I'm not sure that move is going to be sufficient to change things a lot. As you say, there are a lot of people like the president of our university who are hell-bent on inducing change and who care not what they throw away in the process. And I think if these folks are allowed to go on for another 2 years, it may well be difficult, if not impossible, to recover, because they will have destroyed so much of the fabric of the institution that a few Band-Aids just won't help.
Well, you know, my point would be it's going to take some major education on our part to get those people that are in those kind of positions to realize that they're going to go down with the rest of us if they don't start realizing that they got to hold these people accountable and to really start raising the bar on what ethics and how everything needs to be run so that we have something worthy of saving.
That's exactly right. We do need to find some way to convince them that those gated communities do indeed have gates and people can indeed break them down so they aren't quite as safe as they might appear.
I would just like to mention that I think what we're seeing here, this what's going on at our campus and indeed in our country, is a good example of what Naomi Klein calls the shock doctrine of the rise of disaster capitalism. And
yes.
What we see, I'll just read you what it says on the inside. It says, a quote by Milton Friedman, the godfather of the modern market, he says, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around." Okay, so that's the quote from Milton Friedman, who's, you know, from the Chicago School of Economics, and they got the Nobel Prize, et cetera. And she said, it says here on the cover of her book, "At the most chaotic juncture in Iraq's civil war, a new law is unveiled that will allow Shell and BP to claim the country's vast oil reserves. Immediately following September 11th, the Bush administration quietly outsources the running of the war on terror, quote-unquote, to Halliburton and Blackwater. After a powerful tsunami devastates the coasts of Southeast Asia, the pristine beaches are auctioned off to tourist resorts. New Orleans residents, still scattered from Hurricane Katrina, discover that their public housing, hospitals, and schools will never be open. These events are examples of what Naomi Klein calls the shock doctrine, the use of public disorientation following massive collective shocks, wars, terrorist attacks, natural disasters, to push through highly unpopular economic shock therapy. Sometimes when the first two shocks don't succeed in wiping out all resistance, a third shock is employed, that of the electrode in the prison cell or the taser gun, etc." So the idea being that the Chicago School of Economics, these guys know full well that you take advantage of disasters or crises, whether natural or manufactured, many are manufactured, to implement changes that you already had in mind, and I think that what we're seeing on our campus is just exactly a similar case of now we're going to do radical change. It's going to be imposed from the top, and before you can get your act together to resist or to figure out a counter strategy, we're going to effect these changes. What would you say about that, Steve?
I agree. However,
I'd point out a sociologist named Rebecca Solnit, who wrote a book recently called A Paradise Built in Hell. What she does as a research stream is to go off and look at occasions of horrible disasters like Katrina, other things like that. And one of the things she looks for is what people like our president would predict. That is, society disintegrating, everybody out for themselves, things getting worse and worse and worse. And oddly enough, what she finds is really compelling evidence that almost the opposite occurs. That is, people do get together, they find ways to help each other, they find ways to recover from disasters we can barely imagine. So I think that's probably a really optimistic place at which to stop, and maybe that's the appropriate place, that when people do get the chance, when they do see things really falling apart, they get together and they find some way out of the mess created by the few.
Well, that's a great place to stop, Steve, and let's hope we're tiny parts of that process, of that larger process that is
indeed
statewide and nationwide right now.
Yeah, but can I just add one other factor to it? Is at least if we do this, it's the kind of opportunity or change that we want, and not some corporation or other type of government wants to go back to.
Well,
I think
an important point.
Yeah. I think from our point of view as educators, what should not be negotiable, what we should not give up, is the larger mission of trying to set up an environment, what we call a learning center environment in our mission statement, where faculty and students can learn, can explore, can expand their intellectual horizons, and can critically evaluate the world around them. In other words, with the idea that we are citizens, that ultimately we make a difference in this society, that we're not someone else's peon or serf or slave. So with the dignity of the idea of our founding fathers, that we indeed own this society, and that it's ours, and the revolution happened in 1776. We booted the king out, and the phrase that they use, that actually I was thinking we might use some of this language in some future document on campus, maybe, when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Well, I mean, we've been through this as a country, and now it seems like we're having to do it again. But maybe these things, this is an inevitable cycle.
Well, I'd agree. And also that, well, one of the things I see in people's diplomas is that you're awarded this degree and all the rights and appurtenances thereto entitled. And I think what they leave out is, and the duties. And right now we're facing the duties.
Right.
Yeah. And, of course, I just quoted from the Declaration of Independence, and, of course, faculty and students need to claim that their rights, their duties as the essential portion of a university community. I think administrators should have ultimately almost a subordinate role in terms of their job is to facilitate the mission that we carry out.
Well,
yes.
You too, I really want to thank you again for another interesting discussion here. And Steve and Eric, again, I want to thank you. And any closing comments before we call it an evening?
Well, not me. Thank you very much, Steve, for joining us. It's been very informative. I'm hoping some of our students will listen to this. I'll probably assign it to some on a furlough day. And it'll be a resource, maybe our campus radio station can pick it up, and I hope it will continue to do this kind of thing. And we need to get the word out. We need to get our story out. And so, again, Melody, thank you very much for hosting this, and Steve, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thank you both.
Okay. Good night.
Okay, good night.
Good night.